Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to continue with the theme we're doing on Spain and obviously war reporting that I've been talking about recently, and look at, as these two things meet, war reporting journalism and writing in Spain from 1936 to 1939. Now, obviously, a number of names spring to light here. George Orwell and Ernest Hemingway being the most important ones, but obviously there's a kind of a slew of literary and intellectual figures who are engaged with Spain, either on the ground in Spain or speaking out about Spain from Great Britain, the USA, Australia, and the rest of Europe. Spain acts like a lightning rod for debates and struggles that have been ongoing since the end of the First World War. For volunteers from Britain, America and beyond, it was a place to take on fascism. And those young men and women who went to Spain, many of whom who had been deeply affected by the Great Depression, believed that they had a cause they could fight for. As a result, the Spanish Civil War, far beyond the confines of Spain, arouses powerful emotions, and not just on the left. There is a very eminent Welsh historian, R.A. Stradling, who wrote about the Welsh volunteers who went to Spain. And not all of them went to fight against Franco. There was a small minority of people who believed that the Spanish struggle really was a struggle against communism. But because of the intense passions and interests aroused by the Spanish Civil War, there was an immense amount to be written about it and an immense amount of coverage in national and regional newspapers in Great Britain, the USA, and beyond. So this is one of the reasons why it becomes fertile ground for journalists to cover. And in Spain, of course, both sides see the war in Manichaean terms, in a battle between good and evil, light and dark. Both sides see what they are doing as a crusade. George Orwell wrote, "It is a class war. If it had been won, the cause of the common people everywhere would have been strengthened. It was lost, and the dividend drawers all over the world rubbed their hands." And this Manichaean worldview, this black and white struggle, was aided, the perception of it being a Manichaean struggle, was aided by the intervention, obviously, of Hitler and Mussolini on one side and Stalin on the other. Most of the journalists who covered the war were in favour of the Republic, in fact, almost all of them. And there were few impartial figures amongst the press. The great investigative reporter Martha Gellhorn said, "We just knew that Spain was the place to stop fascism. This was it. It was one of those moments in history when there was no doubt." And many of the correspondents in Spain adopted the view that the generals and the insurrection was so monstrous, their crimes so heinous, that an official impartiality was actually a kind of a fraudulent dishonesty. The idea that both sides should be treated as simply equivalents, that one could have no professional inclination towards one way or another. Well, a higher sense of humanity and a belief that the Republic's cause was just and democratic and fair won the day with nearly all correspondents. There was an immense fascination for writers and journalists in the International Brigades. The classic novel For Whom the Bell Tolls by Ernest Hemingway is a classic example of this. But Ernest Hemingway, Arthur Kessler, George Orwell, Stephen Spender, André Malraux, a number of leading intellectual and literary figures came to Spain in this pursuing this kind of fascination with the International Brigades and this kind of rather romantic vision. The reality for the International Brigades is anything but romantic. It is incredibly hard and difficult. Many of the men go hungry, they're poorly equipped. And at the Spanish border, on the Spanish side of the Spanish border, they are given, the volunteers are given one last chance to go home if they want to. Once they decline that opportunity, they're under military discipline and can face execution for desertion if they decide that they've had enough. In the modern era, the Spanish Civil War wasn't the first instance where revolution or the defence of revolution had attracted volunteers and had also attracted romantics and writers. Byron, for example, famously met his end in Greece, going to cover the Greek insurrection against the Ottomans in the 1820s. So the most important journalistic figures in the world made their way to Spain in 1936, and the Republic is delighted with the coverage they get. And we're not just talking about writers. For example, Robert Capa, one of the most important photographers of the 20th century, and his partner Gerda Taro both took very important and significant photos from the Civil War, such as the death of a Republican soldier. Very iconic picture. Gerda Taro herself was killed at the Battle of Brunete after impulsively leaping upon the tailboard of a car that was taking wounded men away from the battlefield, only for it to collide with a Republican tank. These sorts of accidental deaths and deaths from illness, friendly fire, were made up many of the casualties of non-combatants and journalists throughout the war. And the manner of Gerda Taro's death tells us a lot about the risks that journalists endured and do endure, particularly in an age where the correspondent was not issued with a flak jacket or helmet or given a security detail or part of a kind of an embedded force, as you do find in things like the Iraq War. Instead, the people like Martha Gellhorn and Robert Capa made their way to Spain on their own initiative, had very loose relationships with newspaper groups as freelance stringers and photographers or representatives, as Hemingway was, of groups of newspapers, and as a result, correspondents tended to take on far greater levels of risk than would normally be the case. In the various writings on Ernest Hemingway and the Spanish Civil War, he becomes across in some ways as an idealistic figure and others as an egomaniac who was more interested in self-promotion than he was in the cause of the Republic. Hemingway had been an ambulance driver during the First World War, and he was the chairman of the ambulance committee for the American Friends of Spanish Democracy, And before he took on the role of being representative of the North American Newspaper Alliance. So he was the chief go-to man for American correspondents in Spain. He tended to do things like go to the front line and try to teach soldiers in the international brigades about rifle drill. He was obviously this kind of very masculine, larger-than-life figure, but one whose interference, whose kind of appearance on the front line was often unwelcome and would normally be accompanied by a photo shoot involving him. So a man who promoted his own career through Spain. One journalist, Claude Cockburn, who was the reporter who broke the story of the Cliveden set, which was the supposed scandal of aristocrats surrounded Waldorf and Nancy Astor at the country house Cliveden on the eve of the Second World War, along with Times editor Geoffrey Dawson, and it was implied, the direct accusation from Cockburn was that these aristocrats were ready to collude with Hitler and cut a deal with the Third Reich in order to preserve the British Empire. They had sympathies towards the Nazis, certainly, and they believed that the Empire would do best by making a deal with Germany. But actually, the Astors and their friends threw themselves into the war effort when war broke out in 1939. Claude Cockburn was actually in Spain at the time of the outbreak of war, and he joined the Republican Militia, which was distinct from the International Brigades, but continued to work as a correspondent for the Daily Worker magazine, a communist newspaper in Great Britain. Sorry, I call it a magazine there, newspaper. He believed that correspondents should be allowed to fight, and that a correspondent on the battlefield was in some way a more kind of honest and reliable witness to the struggle, which he saw in purely Marxist terms, obviously, than a reporter on the sidelines, so to speak. He didn't believe it was morally valid to write from Madrid, which had been defended successfully by 1936, and extorting other young men to come and fight while doing nothing himself. The decision by George Orwell to go to Spain.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Writing for the New Statesman magazine, the great periodical of the left in Britain, originally founded by Sidney and Beatrice Webb, resulted also in him joining the anarchist PUM brigade in Barcelona. Arthur Koestler, who later became sort of eminent critic of Stalinism, wrote for the London News Chronicle, but was at the same time a Comintern agent. And, of course, Kim Philby was a journalist for the Times, but this was really simply a cover for his work as a Soviet intelligence agent. Philby was able to get quite close to Franco as a result of this, and there are also sort of apocryphal tales that he was persuaded by the KGB to try to poison Franco, probably an inconceivable plan. But his reporting on Spain is actually really quite vivid and insightful stuff, and Philby wrote about colleagues of his whom he saw kind of half an hour earlier, and then their car was hit by an artillery shell. How much use to the Soviets he was in practical intelligence terms in Spain is unclear. Probably his value in Spain was building up himself a legend, a cover, as an establishment figure, which could later be used for excellent effect during his infiltration of MI6. The member of the press corps who did the most to involve themselves on the Republican side was the American journalist for The Nation magazine, Louis Fisher. Louis Fisher became a quartermaster for the International Brigade's depot at Albacete, and eventually he became an arms purchaser for the Republic itself. So a job which really helped to control the supply lines that enabled the Republic to survive. The headquarters of the correspondence was the Florida Hotel in Madrid. I believe a new history of the Florida Hotel came out last year, something I'm looking to get my hands on. If there's any publishers listening to this, please send me a copy. I'll review it for you. But the Florida Hotel was a kind of the inhabitants there were like a who's who of international journalism. There was Ernest Hemingway, Martha Gellhorn, Sefton Delmer, who later reported from Nazi Germany. He wrote for the Daily Express, Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, and the hotel was obviously a bastion of Republican support. Herbert Matthews of the New York Times, who was one of the residents at the Hotel Florida, said, "All of us who lived through the Spanish Civil War felt deeply emotional about it. I always felt the falseness and hypocrisy of those who claimed to be unbiased, and the foolish, if not rank stupidity of editors and readers who demand objectivity or impartiality of correspondents writing about the war. It was the same old error which readers and editors will always make and which forever continues to plague the chronicler who, being human, must have his feelings and opinions. In condemning bias, one rejects the only factors which really matter: honesty, understanding, and thoroughness. A reader has a right to ask for all the facts. He has no right to ask that a journalist or historian agree with them." Richard Overy, in his book The Morbid Age, which, by the way, if you haven't read it, you need to read this book. It's an intellectual history of the 20s and 30s. He says that the crises that come before the Spanish Civil War, from accession to power of Hitler in January 1933 through to Abyssinia in 35, meant that there was this groundswell of tension amongst the population of the Western world, and that the Spanish Civil War sweeps away the ambiguities. The question as to whether war is coming or not is answered with Spain. Yes, it almost uncertainly, the great global struggle with fascism is on. And the war with Germany will be following shortly thereafter. He writes, "The many ambiguities in the British perception of the crisis were suddenly nakedly exposed by the eruption of civil war in Spain following an abortive coup d'etat launched on the 17th and the 18th of July 1936 by a group of Nationalist Army officers led by General Francisco Franco, who had by September become the dominant figure in the revolt." So part of the reason for the fascination with Spain was because it answered, or seemed to answer, so many questions about what was likely to happen next. as many correspondents said, Spain was the place that fascism could be stopped. And if the consequences of it not being stopped, people, reading populations and readerships all across the Western world and radio audiences didn't want to even contemplate what those consequences could be. Some conflicts to audiences seem impossibly remote and a thing that they are not connected with, whereas Spain was a conflict which animated passions because many people across the Western world were intimately connected with it because they saw in Spain the mirror of their own futures. The intellectual Noel Annan, who was at Cambridge University when the war began, said that the left intelligentsia was obsessed by the outcome of the war and hopefully the defeat of fascism. But the pro-Franco sympathies that existed in Britain shouldn't be ignored either. Tom Dryburgh, the famous journalist and later Member of Parliament, said that he describes a pro-Franco meeting at the Queen's Hall in London in April 1938, where the platform bore a rich load of furs, jewels, spats and paunches. And well-modulated voices shouted out Viva Franco as if the words were English. As I've previously said in this podcast several times before, and indeed George Orwell has said, the Spanish Civil War really is a class war. The struggle by the generals is directed at the workers and the peasants of Spain to really put them back into their place in the most bloodthirsty manner possible. And after, in the 20s and 30s, there is a widespread anxiety in Europe, in Britain, in America, and in other First World countries that, following the Russian Revolution, the working classes are basically unmanageable and a dreadful threat. And what of the appeal of fascism to the upper classes and upper middle classes in Great Britain? Not all of them, by any stretch of the imagination, were fascist, but those who were within the upper classes looked upon it generally in class terms, that this is how you can defend yourself against the evils of Bolshevism. Robert Graves, the First World War veteran and poet, writer of I, Claudius and all that, said, "Never since the French Revolution had there been a foreign question that has so divided intelligent British opinion." He referred, obviously, to the Whig Edmund Burke and his detractors. Burke, who thought the French Revolution was a terrible thing and the unleashing of mob rule. I mean, this becomes the kind of the founding idea, really, of conservatism, that if change at all must happen, it must be gradual and moderate and slow and must not give in to the animal passions of the mob. And many people disagree with him. But anyway, part of the appeal of Spain, why there are volunteers who go there, is that other than punch-ups with Mosley's black shirts on the streets of London and other cities up and down Great Britain, there isn't a real battlefield on which to fight fascism until, obviously, in 1936, when there is. David Gascoigne, the British poet, a friend wrote to him saying, "You will feel you're alive out there. Here everything is so unreal," implying that the thrill of combat, of battle, gave an added sense of aliveness, but also a sense of unreality to many people that went out to fight. There were those that put the toe in the water, like W.H. Auden, the famous poet. Auden popped out to Spain temporarily and returned. There were a sort of the fellow traveller movement, of which I've spoken about extensively, who often took essentially package tours to Russia to see how Stalinism was working out. The fellow traveller movement also quite liked to go to Spain, where they could find the sort of authenticity and proletarian verve that seemed to be missing in complacent old Great Britain. Most of those don't go near the front line. and they come home fairly swiftly. Many who came home hadn't been shot at by the Nationalists, but they had seen communists, social democrats, anarchists and Basque separatists fighting with one another. And many came home with quite a dim and pessimistic view of the left, that it would never organise itself sufficiently to be able to take on fascism, which was a fair assessment. Anyway, I'll finish there. I hope you found this useful and helpful. And if you are able to, and you can check out our Patreon page, give us a donation. That would be greatly received. And also, if you can, give us a review on the Explaining History iTunes page. And I'll catch you on the next podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.